You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Here on a Thursday, joined by the one and only, the man from Texas, Mike Musselman. What is up, man?
Not much, man.
I give you the big intro today.
I saw that. Hey, did you see I got another pistol last night?
I did. What the hell? We'll talk about that in a minute. I played an interview today that I did a few months ago. The guy's name is Cal Humphrey. He was a PFC on Iwo Jima. And I love, listen to those guys talk about the world they lived in. You know, he leaves Missouri. He didn't really know much about the Marine Corps. His older brother was in it. Older brother was an officer. My friend's father, Jess's father, Robert Humphrey. But Cal, he goes to Hawaii and he's training with the 4th Marine Division, the 5th Marine Division, I think. It's the only fight they ever fight is Iwo Jima. And he tells this, this story, he mentioned John Bazelon. I said, well, how did you meet him? He said, well, when we weren't training, we'd go down and drink beer at the slop shoot for 15 cents. And the slop shoot was essentially a beer hall. And he meets John Bazelon. He said, oh, he's a great guy. But the stories that those guys tell, Mike, as a gunner, and a fairly social person, there's a lot of stuff that goes on at Camp Pendleton, throughout the course of a year. And then as you're there for years and years and years, whether it be anniversaries or all kinds of different things where you cross paths with Marines, you've had a chance to meet some interesting guys who were on Iwo Jima. Give me a couple memories that you have, of those guys.
Like you said, I had the opportunity of, because of my, where I worked and what I did is meet a lot of guys that were, I met guys that were, in, Gunnery Sergeant John Bathlon's platoon, that knew these legends and served by them, and they were in their own right legends themselves. So, pretty amazing, as far as being a Marine and actually meeting the people that kind of set the path for us. So.
I was teaching in Quantico and we got a phone call from the basic school and they said, hey, we've got a guy here. He was a platoon commander on Iwo Jima. Would you guys like to have lunch with him?
Yeah.
What? Hell yes. So I ran over and to get him, and I've had an Iwo Jima interest for years. And his name is Keith Wells. He passed away, I want to say, last year or the year before. And he's a big guy. I think he was probably in his 70s, maybe late 60s when I met him. And so we brought him over to IOC and we got out maps of Iwo Jima and he took us through the battle till, he got wounded. Just the way, you're sitting there with a map and getting to, like, with a piece of American history, a sacred American history at that, especially for Marines, that battle. And, he just talked about, the things you saw and the crazy things that happened and the randomness that, guys wrestle with for years after it. Why him, not me? And ultimately there is no answer to that. It's just the way, the way the medal flew that day and it wasn't meant for you. But he talked about, we fought our way. He was in 28th Marines. So they land at the foot of Mount Suribachi and they fight their way across the island And two things, stories that he told, that he carried a Thompson machine gun, and they run up against his bunker, and he said we could hear the Japanese inside the bunker, but they wouldn't come out. We couldn't get them to come out. And, you know, we'd throw grenades in, they'd throw them back out. And he said stuff, he said it was crazy. And so he said, I had a thermite grenade, so we threw the thermite grenade in there. And with that, we hear him screaming and yelling, and then the door opens, and he said they came out, and they had, the Japanese wore these shoes, called what, Mike, tabi shoes, and the big toe was separate from the rest of the front of the shoe. So he said the smoke comes billowing out, and then they came out running, bent over. Every one of them had the bayonet scabbard of the guy in front of them, and they stayed low, and you could see the tabby shoes coming out. And he said, and I laid them out for inspection, all 11 of them with my Thompson. And you're like, and yeah. And he said, and so he talked about that. He said, me and three other Marines, he said, we just started shooting. And, you know, we killed all of them. He said, then we got across the island, and we were trying to tie in that night. And he said, you know, in our training at Pearl Harbor, you know, in Hawaii, we'd always put out wire in front of our positions. He said, so what do? I'm bouncing wire in front of my platoon. And he said, but, you know, nothing happens to me. And he said, the two other platoon commanders that saw me do it, and then they did it, they were like, oh yeah, Wells is doing it. I need to do it. He said they both got shot. One of them got killed, and the other one, you know, was wounded. And he said, I felt horrible ever since that. He said, how stupid was that? Like that piece of concertina was going to stop anything. He said we never did it again. And, but it was really interesting, to sit and talk with him, with those guys. Give me a story that you remember from an Iwo Jima guy.
I don't know if I ever told you this, but when I was on recruiting duty, a guy named, Whalen, what was his first name? John Whalen. And, he had joined the Marine Corps based on these, posters, you know, about wearing blues, and then went out to Iwo Jima, served, got wounded, was awarded the Navy Cross for his voluntary, along with other things, and then was sent home because he was really wounded back to San Francisco. He lived in Auburn, California, and then got out of the Marine Corps there. Never got his blues, much less his alphas. And so I ran across him at a VFW event, and then through some channels of mine, I found an old 40-something pair of chevrons and Eagle Globe anchors and a set of blues. We bought it for him, had it tailored to him, and then presented it to with all of his ribbons on the blues at a VFW meeting. And this guy was wheelchair-bound. I mean, he was so frail. And when we opened up his blues that were basically on the hanger and stuff, this guy started, he stood up, and I thought he was going to die. Stood up, shaking, getting out of the wheelchair, trying to get his shirt off, and he wanted to get in those pair of blues. Finally, backstage, we got him dressed up, and he came back out, and he's standing there saluting. And it was just an amazing, you know, to see this guy, things that he'd been through, and the times that he'd gone, and, you know, get back into his pair of blues. So, pretty amazing.
How cool is that? And a lot of these guys, you know, that fought on Iwo Jima, you know, a lot of them wounded, they weren't even in the Marine Corps for 2 years.
Oh, not even,
right?
Not even, yeah, right. Not even that long.
Right. They were filling out the 4th and 5th Divisions. The 5th Divisions were guys who fought on what? Guadalcanal, Cape Gloucester, mm-hmm. Saipan. Then they took the NCOs out of a lot of those units and made them the core of the 5th Division and gave them all these new guys who joined the Marine Corps in 44, right? They flush out the 5th Division. It's in Hawaii training. And Cal Humphrey, who was on today, was one of those kind of guys. But if you got wounded on Iwo Jima, that was April of 45, you were home, you know, fairly soon thereafter. you know, in a hospital or whatever, you're at least stateside, and then you were discharged from the military. And that was your military, military service, a grand total of maybe 18 months if you got wounded on there. Crazy. Yeah. Crazy. I did a paper, when I went to the armor school, the guy there, as if you didn't have enough to do, the guy who was like the head of the Marines at Fort Knox, he said, "You guys have to write something for me." Like, what? Like, aren't you just supposed to be like supporting me? Like, why am I writing something for you? And he said, "You got to write about an armor battle in World War II, or an armor battle in Marine Corps history." So I picked Iwo Jima, and I'd just written a bunch of stuff in Quantico, and I didn't want to go kind of do book research about it. So I made this little questionnaire, and I called the Marine Corps Association, and I asked them names. Four names of guys who they knew were tankers on Iwo Jima. And I called these guys up. And, man, Mike, the stories that they told me were incredible. Absolutely, positively incredible. First of all, the Marine Corps was a different place then. They messed with everything, right? And because of the draft, they had pipe fitters. They had welders. They had optical guys. So they messed with everything on their tanks. And they welded penny nails like to the hood. They welded track to the turret. They created wooden, forms and poured concrete on the side. So if you'll see pictures of tanks on Iwo Jima that you'll see what looks like a wooden frame on the side. That's because that's what that is. And it's really what they're doing was creating spaced armor, you know, their own ghetto style in World War II. And it was one of the coolest things I ever did academically in the Marine Corps because they were so fun to talk to. Because, you know, all of a sudden here's this captain calling them up and wanting them to talk about the battle. But, one of the interviews I'll never forget, and I just ran across it a few months ago, was, and I was just taking notes, right? I had these forms and I'd take notes and, was this guy and he said, they were funny, hold on, let me put my teeth in. And, so he goes and puts his teeth in and he says, you know, I never talk about the battle except with Marines. He said, but I'm happy to. And I said, so I'd ask him questions like, what was the first thing you ever remember seeing on Iwo Jima? And he said, well, the bow doors open on our LST. He said, you know, the typical story. We were told we may not go ashore, you know, with the way the bombardment was supposed to go. You know, this thing could be pretty easy, blah, 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 blah. He said, 4 hours into the fight, we're landing. So the bow doors open, and the first thing I see that I've never forgotten is a Marine. He's got his feet on the tire of a 37-millimeter gun that's attached to a Jeep. And it's swamped in the surf just in front of the beach. And he's taking a shit. He said, that's the first thing I saw of Iwo Jima. And I'm like, what? He said, yeah. He said, I can't, you know, it's my first image of Iwo Jima. I'll never forget it. And I said, but he talked to me about, you know, he said, it was a pretty grim place. He said, you know, I'll never forget once. The infantry guys had these Japanese holed up in a cave, but they couldn't get to the cave close enough to do away with them. And he said, so we had a bulldozer building a road so that we could get to a position to shoot napalm into it. And the Marines had an interpreter on a speaker, and he said the Marines were pissed. He said, let me tell you, he said the grunts on that island, he said, that was gruesome, hard work, you know, and they did it every day.
Oh, yeah.
And every one of them expected to die because they just had seen so much of it. He said, and they were pissed. And so he said, essentially what they had was this interpreter talking shit to the Japanese, telling them that they were going to burn to death. And it was going to be less than an hour. And he said, and they kept us up, and then we drove up, and then we burned them all. And he said, and then we went on. He said, but I'll never forget that, listening to that, and then those guys knowing they were going to die, not surrendering, and us going up and killing them all. And then at the end of the interview, he says to me, I said, hey, what if I don't include in this thing I'm writing, would make it incomplete. And he said, well, if they don't understand how tough the Japanese were, then you won't have done this right. And I said, all right, well, I promise you, I'll make sure I'll include that. And he said, great. And then I thanked him for doing the interview, and he said, hey, Captain, one more thing. And I said, what's that, sir? And he said, remember how tough I told you they were? And I said, yes, sir. He said, we kicked their fucking asses right off that, right off that island. He said, we were tougher. So, you know how cool it is, Mike? After all the years that have gone by.
Right.
They still feel that swag, that chip on their shoulder of being a Marine. And it's just really cool to run across these guys in your career as a Marine and get a chance to, like, sit down and shut up and listen to them tell their story. But pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
All right, tell me about your pistol.
It's a Smith & Wesson.
Why another pistol? You just bought how many the other day?
Just two.
So you felt the need to get a third one this week?
Well, this one was for the wife.
Oh, well, that makes it all good then. All right, so tell me about it. Girl guns. Let's talk about girl guns.
Well, no, this is a Smith & Wesson 9mm shield, so it's a...
What's the shield mean?
It's just a smaller, more compact, easy to carry pistol.
Ooh, we like that.
Yeah.
All right, so where did you... Was this a target of opportunity, or was this a planned purchase, or something you'd been looking for?
No, the wife saw it. She really liked it.
Oh,
we were, you know, she put it in, put it in her hand, liked the way the grip was, and everything else. So, yeah.
All right. So tell me what it is, so I can take a look at it. Smith & Wesson.
Smith & Wesson 9mm shield. Good gun, great gun, Smith & Wesson. And it's, when you take it apart and you look at it, it's a really good takeoff of the Glock. So
that's what I was going to say. It, you know, pulling up the image of it, like, Glock better lock their stuff up because Smith & Wesson is cheating. Because that's exactly what it looks like, yes?
Yeah.
All right, talk to me about what makes it a good, other than the way it... All right. How many total pistols does that make for the Musselman house?
I don't know, man.
Give me it like between 20 and 40?
No, not that much. That's a lot. That's ridiculous.
Okay, so between 10 and 20? Easily, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere,
Somewhere between 10 and 20. Okay, does this count against the total? Because this is for your wife.
No, this is hers.
This is a separate category. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So what makes it, other than the way it felt in her hand, or was that the primary feature of it?
That's the primary feature. So, you know, like I said, let them pick the ones that they like, that are comfortable with. You know, that's easier for them to manipulate, and then you can never go wrong.
Okay. More girl gun questions for you. A lot of times it's difficult for people to rack the slide to the rear. Is the tension on that spring, is it different on a girl gun?
No. I mean, different guns have different tensions. So,
right.
Like I said, you just got to find the one that best suits them.
Okay. So not necessarily less tension on a girl gun, although it seems logically there ought to be.
It's a little bit less than the Glocks, but no, not much.
Not much. Wow.
And for a 9mm, it's pretty good.
Okay. Ammunition. Is there girl ammunition?
No.
There's no girl ammunition that doesn't have as many grains?
Well, no. I mean, you can. The grains is the weight of the bullet. So you're looking at the load. So, like, I mean, your higher load ammo, like your plus P's, plus performance, they got more powder in them.
Right.
You know, so you're going to get a little bit more of a recoil.
We don't want that, though, right, on a girl gun. We want less recoil. We want them to feel comfortable with it.
Right. So, yeah, your regular ball ammunition is fine. And then for target shooting, then you carry ammunition, you're just going to get your standard jacketed hollow points.
Standard jacketed hollow points. And don't get mad when I ask this, because I'm asking this because people are listening. And so regular standard hollow points have enough stopping power in a 9mm like this for a woman for it to do the job.
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as stopping power. But
you know, you know, I have to ask you though. So tell me about stopping power then. Tell everybody again why there's no such thing as stopping power.
Well, because it doesn't, you know, you don't have a magic bullet. It doesn't stop. One bullet doesn't stop somebody. You know, it's where you put it. So, you know, you can shoot a 22 and have just as much stopping power than a millimeter, because if you hit someone just right, they're going to stop.
So the criticism of the 9mm is that it didn't have the stopping power that the 45 had.
Yeah, that's no such thing. You're talking about permanent wound cavity, you know, the transfer of energy once it hits the target. What does that look like? It causes more displacement. You know, 45 is going to cause more displacement because it's just a bigger round. So you have more energy striking the target. But then the drawback is, you know, weight, recoil, less ammunition, range, whereas your 9mm. And then that difference is not great. It's not that huge. So if you buy the right round, you can get, you know, more controlled, better expansion on a 9mm. It'll expand, you know, a little bit bigger than the normal size. Once it strikes something, it flattens out. And then pushes all that stuff aside.
All right, let me read you an email. Hey, Mac, I love Gun Talk, and I am curious about the elements of buying a good weapon for a woman.
Okay, so...
Hold on, he goes on. Mac, I don't appreciate you calling them girls. Oh, yeah, really? Okay, you want to know what I appreciate? We'll get to that in a second. So I'm curious. So one of the things Mike's made me smart about is grip on a weapon for a woman should feel comfortable. Weight should feel comfortable. I'm just now considering spring tension and her ability to move the slide to the rear, in addition to stopping power, and then he puts a happy face. All of that obviously contributes to her feeling confident with the weapon, which is the single most important thing, in my opinion, that she's comfortable, confident, and not afraid to employ it because of recoil or any other thing. It's not a beast to her, kind of looked at as like this, oh, what is this? It's something that she sees and she's confident and she enjoys shooting it and therefore not afraid. Mike's thoughts on all that.
Okay, so when you're judging a pistol size, one of the key factors, so if you're right-handed, if you hold your right hand out and your thumb and your index finger makes an L, right?
Yes. I'm doing this, by the way.
In that corner in the L where your thumb goes down into your palm, and then if you draw a straight line from your index finger, that's the crotch of your thumb. Okay? Where that corner is in the L.
Okay.
All right. So when you grip a pistol and you hold it in your hand with your right hand or your left hand, whatever it is.
Okay.
You want to make sure that when you look at the top slide from the front sight blade all the way back, you draw an imaginary line, and that line should go all the way down straight to the wrist and all the way down the forearm to the elbow.
Okay.
It should be one straight line.
Okay.
Okay. And then when you do that, you're holding the pistol correctly. And then you, when you put your trigger finger in, you should be able to engage the trigger with that first joint on your index finger from your fingernail back to that first joint.
Okay. And that has to do with length of the pistol and things like that, right?
Right.
Okay.
So that's, you want to make sure that.
Wait,
that,
what's the first joint? Is it the one that's farthest away from my palm, or is the first joint the one at the base?
From your fingertip.
So that's the first.
Yeah.
All right, got it. All right, so the tip of my finger, I should be able to engage
that first joint.
Your joint
should be on the trigger, and not your fingertip.
Right.
That's too long, and if it's too short, if it goes towards that second joint, it's too short.
All right.
And then it starts to be really a harder weapon to manage when it comes to start recoil. But the most important thing is, if you put that in your hand and you look at the front side blade and you go down the slide, it should be a straight line that goes all the way down your forearm to your elbow. It shouldn't be canted in any way. So hold it like that, and then that'll judge that. And then when you put your trigger finger in there, you want at least that first joint, you know, to be touching that trigger.
Okay, I got that.
If it's too far down, then it's too long of a pistol. And then there's some pistols you can get what they call back straps on the back edge of that pistol that can lengthen that and adjust that pull. So you can change out the back straps on pistols. Smith & Wesson, M&P's have it too. Glocks have it, and a bunch of others do. SIGs. And so you want to adjust that to make sure that fits that perfectly. And then, like you said, slide. Also, some slides, before you purchase a gun, look at aftermarket products. So, your recoil dampening, your guide rod, that manages the recoil.
Right.
You can actually buy some that actually change the amount of pull. So, I think a standard Glock is like 20 pounds of pressure to pull that spring back.
Okay.
So it's pretty stiff. And you can buy different guide rods that go all the way down to 11 pounds, but you just got to make sure when you're shooting that, your ammunition, you're following the manufacturer, or you're following that guideline. Is you don't want really powerful rounds for weaker strings, because it's really going to, it's going to do, a lot of considerable more recoil and cause maybe some damage to the gun.
To the weapon itself.
Yeah, so the more power you have in the round, you want a stronger recoil spring.
Okay. So
so lower loads, you want to have.
So if I am building my girl gun, I don't care. Deal with it. If I am building my girl gun and I do go to a lighter spring, is that the right term? Lighter spring?
Yeah, a lighter guide rod, lighter spring.
Okay, if I go to a lighter guide rod spring, then I, by necessity, I need to lighten the ammunition as well.
Right.
Okay. All right, but...
Yeah, don't fire what we call the hotter rounds.
Okay. Don't, in terms of quote-unquote stopping power, okay, even the lighter loaded, the lighter weighted ammunition, the lighter load ammunition is going to have enough stopping power as long as it should be a hollow point bullet, and it should be well aimed. And the chances of her doing that are going to be much higher if she, for instance, I will tell you this. I mean, I taught my kids pistol shooting with a 45, okay, and they were teenage boys, right? And that was a manly event. You better be manned up on that thing, because that pistol was going to go. You better hold that thing, or else you're going to get hit right in the forehead with the recoil. And so they learned. But they were never, until they got to be, I don't know, probably older than 15, where they had a little bit more arm strength. They weren't real cool. They didn't enjoy firing it. It was kind of a beast, and they looked at it like that. As opposed to looking at it like, yeah, give me that thing, let me shoot. And I think that's what we're talking about, a level of comfort and even enthusiasm. you know, with this weapon that, yeah, it's it feels good in my hand. The trigger pull is good. The recoil is good. It's all comfortable for me. And then if you buy hollow point ammunition, that will certainly, in that mix, that will there's certainly enough in there to stop somebody.
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
Yeah, and like I said, it comes down to shot placement. That's the critical key, you know, center mass, center chest, in the sternum, you're gonna cause the most damage, and thus you're gonna achieve what you want, is you're gonna stop the threat.
Okay, our friend in Montana, he likes the Ruger LCP2. He said it's a good girl gun.
Okay.
Are you familiar with it?
No, I don't buy Rugers.
Why don't are you not a Ruger?
Ruger
guy?
Makes a good 10/22.
What's
and that's about it.
10/22, what is that?
It's a semi-automatic 22 rifle.
And so,
it's a good gun to start out on.
And that's it?
Yeah. There's a lot of people that love Rugers. I'm just not one of them. I'm
okay.
A Ruger fan.
All right. So pistol, you're a Glock guy. Rifle, you're a?
Assault rifle?
Assault rifle, you are a?
I'm a LaRue guy and an LMT guy, Lewis Machine and Tool.
All right. And a bolt-action rifle guy?
I am strictly a custom guy.
Ooh. Wow.
So, custom.
He's a custom. He's one of a kind. He's a custom guy. All right, email. Hey, Mac. Love the interview today, and I love the Iwo Jima talk. What do you and Mike think are the most difficult things that they did on that island? Mike, most difficult thing they did on that island?
Stay alive. That island had no cover, had no trees, had no grass. All it was rock and sand. I mean, just maneuvering through that was... It was extremely difficult, but just, I mean, I've been on that island and I walked that island, and it's just amazing to me to know that many people, both Japanese and Marines, were fighting on that island at one time. I mean, you could see clearly across the other side, from one side to the other. I mean, you see the edge of the island. It's not big at all.
Yeah, it's 2 miles by 2 miles at the pork chop, in the square part of the pork chop. 2 miles by 2 miles, and every bit of vegetation gone when they fought there. I'll quote Cal Humphrey. That guy who set that island up was a genius. They never did anything foolish. They never showed themselves. You knew they were there because they were killing you. Hell, it was like fighting ghosts. And he said that they were a week into the fight, and he said to his squad leader, a guy named Les Jenks, he said, "Les, I haven't even seen a Japanese show himself on this island yet."
Yeah.
And,
they lived mostly underground. Yeah. So, I mean, that was...
completely.
You know, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They rolled, fighting in
caves and bunkers, close proximity. I mean, it's a tough fight. I mean, look at all of those islands, Mac. You know, I mean, Kowloon, Tarawa. I mean, they were just difficult fights.
Yeah, no. So I'm just trying to think. There's a spot. There's like three crazy spots in that battle. One of them is as you're looking at the beach to the right. There's this place called the meat grinder. Shut your door, man. What the?
No, it's the seatbelt thing.
All right. Well, put your seatbelt on. What the hell's wrong with
it
you?
It is on, but it does it anyway.
It's called the, there was a meat grinder and then this thing called the Turkey Knob. I want to say that was 25th Marines. If you watch their daily progress, they don't move. They fought and they fought and they fought, and they were moving like feet a day if that some days. And then there was this hill on the western side of the island called Hill 362 Alpha that they turned into a mountainous pillbox. They honeycombed, and then, and so as the Marines came up kind of the west coast, they dealt with this hill in front of them. But then towards the center of the island, all the ridgeline that faced them, there were all positions in there that covered the approaches to Hill 362 Alpha.
Right. Yeah, there was like canyons back there. I remember right. walking through there. Again, you don't see it from you're standing there. And there's not a lot. I mean, when you're on the island, the only really big elevation is Mount Sarabatu. And then on the backside of the island, from the beaches, you know, the furthest point from there, there's canyons. There's like gorges cut out. And so you get down in there and now there's cliffs again and you're out, there's other elevation, you know, and then there's sulfur. There's like these sulfur fields on the other side of the beaches at the choke point there at Sarabatu. You know, really kind of weird looking ground, a lot of lava fields. The island is crazy.
Yeah.
I remember just the reminiscent smell of sulfur coming to the volcanic island. And you see these steam vents, you know, coming out of the island in certain places.
Yeah. Crazy, and it is because it's undisturbed from the war, other than building that runway.
The Japanese still have a base there, and we used to have a Coast Guard Lorraine station there.
Right.
When I landed there.
No, there's all kinds of cool pictures from like the '60s of you know guys getting stationed there, and there was no Japanese presence at that time, and they would go into the caves. And you know and check stuff out until the Japanese you know got invited back to the island. And the Japanese said, "Hey, please don't go there. Our dead are there." And they obviously honored it, but they said it was kind of crazy to be there alone for all those months, and they'd go exploring.
When I was there in 1985, the Japanese families were still making pilgrimages to the island to respect their fallen loved ones because they would have fresh. You know, bottles of sake or rice or, you know, whatever, pitchers on their gravestones all over the place. And they would fly down there. And the Japanese flew Phantom jets, part of their defense force from there. But there was probably less than 100 Japanese guys would work on the island at one time. And like you said, they were really respected. I mean, they respected both sides,
right.
Which was kind of neat, you know. They would go around. They would go through the division cemeteries that were still there at the time, and clean those up and maintain those just as much as they do their own.
Yeah, no, that's. I got a couple of emails for you. One is about girl guns. The Ruger LCP2 in .38 caliber is a great girl rig. They make reduced recoil ammo in both ball. Ammo and hollow point! ! So,
yeah, but I'm not find a gun that suits your girlfriend or your wife or your daughter or your sister or whatever mother that she's really comfortable with, and then work into it. I just hate if you're going to get something like that where it's all reduced, then you're reducing capabilities overall.
Okay. All right. Here's another one. So a 50 cal shot at the shoulder does not have more stopping power than a 7.51 shot in the shoulder, which does not have more stopping power than a 5.56 shot in the shoulder. What about the history of the .38 service pistol against the Moro Indians in the Philippines? That's what led to the development of the 45.
That was a lie. The 38 to go to the 9mm because they were over penetrating. Because they were used, again, they wanted a slower round. So, but see, that's what we're talking. Okay, so.
Hold on. Let me just finish the email.
Okay.
That's what led to the development of the 45. For, in all caps, more stopping power. Final hold on. Of course, all caps. Shot placement trumps everything else. But what about the imperfect shot? Gunner.
Okay. So we go back to, okay. So there's a thing called temporary wound cavity and permanent wound cavity. Okay.
Okay.
And that's when the bullet enters your body and that energy is displaced into your body. It pushes all of your internal organs and everything out of the way. What you want to achieve is greater permanent wound cavity because that's the damage that's being done to your internal organs. Permanent wound cavity or temporary wound cavity is when it just gets pushed out and it collapses back. And it's still intact and there's no hemorrhaging of any vital organs. So when that thing goes into your body, okay, and that was the classic 38. It's the same argument with the 9mm. Okay, so people were arguing that the 9mm didn't have stopping power. Well, the problem came into was when you look at those cases, they were shooting people with ball ammunition. Or
wait. So when you say cases, you mean when you look into those incidents, not casing.
Right.
Okay.
Right. In those incidents. Those incidents would show that they had over penetration. The ball ammo would penetrate and then go all the way through and basically leave like an ice pick, a clean hole all the way through and not cause massive wound trauma, permanent wound cavity into the body. So when they looked at it and they were basically shooting into big gelatin blocks that were 40 pound blocks,
right?
You know, that were, shoot, a couple feet long. What they were finding when they measured it, you can see through it, and they put it on slow motion, when the bullet would penetrate and go through, you had a temporary wound cavity, and then when the round basically started to cause what they call damage, it was already past where the body would be, the body cavity. It's beyond that. It's at, you know, 16, 18 inches.
Got it.
Well, that's already passed through your body. So on the advent, when they came out with bonded technology, where they actually chemically bonded the lead and the copper together, and they had serrations on the copper jacket to allow it to pull back and expand better, slowing the bullet down and causing more expansion, thus causing more permanent wound cavity, thus causing more permanent trauma to the body, they started seeing the results that they wanted. So it was a combination of guns, wrong guns. They were firing too high of feet per second. They were traveling too fast. And the ammunition wasn't designed to actually cause permanent wound cavity. It was target ammunition. So okay. You don't hear a lot of that anymore. So, you know, and that's, he's right. So when they were looking at the 38, the problem with 38 is it just punched holes right through people and wouldn't stop them. So thus came the word stopping power. You know, well, it wasn't stopping these guys, but the 45 would, because, you know, it would stop these guys. Well, no, it wasn't because the round was slower and it was bigger and it flattened out faster and it had less chance to over penetrate. Thus you saw more of this, what we call again, stopping power, where people would talk about, well, I shot him at 45 and he stopped with one shot. You know, I would say, if you go back in time and you gave them the correct 38 ammo, there would never been an argument. And maybe it'd never been a 45. They looked at the wrong,
factor,
and then they created they basically came out with that gun. Where if they would have looked at the bullet factor and changed the bullet dynamic, they would have achieved the same goal.
Of stopping power.
But they didn't know that then, right?
They were all stupid gun guys back then. Let me just tell you,
just didn't know what we know now. They didn't have the technology. They didn't have 20,000 frames per second cameras.
Right.
They didn't test the stuff into cadavers and things like that. A lot of it was field testing. They shot in the field, and man, did this. Okay, so that's it's good.
I go back to my reading what General Day said, when he got out of the Marine Corps about things that he was sad to see leave the inventory. And this is 1984, 1985, when I was a second lieutenant with 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, in Okinawa, but he was, retiring from the Marine Corps, and, he was a CG of Okinawa, where he had gone ashore as a PFC. And, he said, of all the things that are leaving that I hate to see, he said, I hate to see, you're being complimented on that explanation, by the way. Well done, Gunner. Good explanation. He said, look, I hate to see the 45 leave, and here's why. He said, you know, as a, when you were part of a machine gun team and you were, and that 45 was on your hip, you know, sometimes you've had to pull that thing out in a hurry, and if you nick somebody, they were going down, right? And so, but your point is, the same results would have happened with the 38 if they would have got the ammunition right.
Right. Or the 9mm Beretta. The 9mm Beretta we used in, when we would deploy to combat with a 9mm sidearm, we used the same ammunition that we'd shoot paper targets with. That's ludicrous. It's absolutely absurd.
Why did we do that?
Who does that?
I don't know. We do.
Because we get around these, you know, and it wasn't the Geneva Convention for all those that talk about expansion.
It was the Hague Accords
that talked about that, that act that talked about expanding bullets and undue suffering. You know, and the way it's worded today is we can use what people classify as hollow points. We use them in the military today in rifles, but we don't call them that. They're not hollow point bullets. They're called open tip mats. They have a pocket on the tip of the round that provides better accuracy. It stabilizes the bullet better than a normal bullet.
And oh, by the way.
Yeah. And by the way, a second order effect is when it hits something, it expands.
Boom!
But that's not what we built the bullet for. That was
of course we didn't.
Right. Hollow points were built that way. They were designed to expand. Thus, we could never use them because of we signed the Hague Accords that said that we couldn't use expanding bullets.
Exactly.
Right.
But
so you change the terminology, you change the factor of the way you look at a problem, and you design a pistol bullet with an open tip that provides better stability in flight. Oh, by the way, when it does hit something, that's okay because that's not the primary purpose. It's a second order effect. So you got to change. If you want to use pistols in combat, I'm sorry. You have to change the ammunition. And the ammunition has to be some type of open tip bullet. Because you want rapid expansion, because you want to put the person down. If you don't, you're going to have the same problem. You're going to go to combat with target ammo. It's designed to put holes in paper. That's it.
But isn't it better not to reject the term stopping power and just know the components of stopping power? And they're not all caliber. It's not only the caliber.
You can use the word stopping power.
Oh,
but
okay.
You've got to understand what the word entails.
Okay.
It entails shot placement, permanent wound cavity, temporary wound cavity, you know, muzzle velocity, expansion, weight retention, penetration, you know, blind barrier penetration. So it's blind barriers. It'll penetrate the same, whatever barrier, if it's, you know, 17 gauge steel door, auto glass, sheetrock, heavy clothing. It performs exactly the same throughout, thus it's blind to barriers.
Okay, email question. Why the fuck do we go to war with ball ammunition? Text message question. That is nuts that we go to combat with ball ammunition. Whose idea is that?
Yeah, tell me about it.
Well, aren't you a gunner? Aren't you supposed to unfuck that?
And we did, Mac. We did. But we couldn't win the pistol battle. We won the rifle battle.
How could we not win one or not the other?
We had AB-69, which was a SOS bullet, science and operation type, special operations science technology bullet.
Right.
That was basically a hunting bullet designed to shoot game. You know, for whoever wrote that, I wrote papers and articles all the time about how ludicrous for us to use a rifle in combat with that stupid, you know, green tip, steel core jacketed bullet that was over-penetrating our enemy, you know, same problem. It was just putting ice pick holes through everybody, not causing permanent wound cavity, not slowing the guy down. And eventually, people, we changed, and we went to these, the Black Hill 77 grain, heavier bullet, open tip match, what they call OTM. We went to basically like a Horton D tap round, which was the AB69, and we started doing that. And now we just got better. And then the Army went back with the M80A5 green tip, A1, and we went back to basically ice pick rounds.
Why?
Because people don't, they get
what's
crowded.
Was there any trade off, Mike, in terms of distance and ability?
No. That green tip round was a piece of shit when it came to what we call minute of angle shooting.
Right.
It was all over the place. So for people to understand this, your normal gun, government gun, was an acceptance test. It had to be accepted. It had to shoot, I think it was maybe within 2 minutes. So 2 minutes is 2 inches at 100 yards. Okay? So do the math. At 500, it's 10 inches. Okay? So that's shitty. Two minutes at 100 yards is 2 inches from center, where you aim. That was acceptable. But no one really cared about, well, we didn't shoot other than the rifle range. You know, we didn't shoot at that great distance. And when we started looking at it, then you take the shooter. Your average shooter wasn't a minute of angle guy. He was another 2 minutes because he sucked. And the bullet was another 2 minutes. So, you know, as far as accuracy. So on best, you know, on worst case days, you're at 6 minutes of 6 minutes. So six inches out of center. I'd always congratulate people for hitting a bullseye, you know, at 500 yards because you're shooting at a 19 inch target, black target, but in essence, you're shooting a 6 foot white block, 6 foot by 6 foot square out at 500 yards. You're seeing center mass at it. And it was a miracle that you hit, you know, every time. But like I said, we compensated that either through, clicks and windage. And I mean, who's going to adjust their windage on the front sight post in combat? Oh, take the bullet out, push that little detent in and rotate the round, you know, six clicks up. No, that's a competition shooting rifle that we use for combat.
All right, stop it. You're depressing me now.
Yeah.
I was happy. I was happy, and now I'm not happy.
We've been trying to fight, and the guys that are still waging that war now, Chris Wade, Gunner Chris Wade, who replaced me a long time ago on Quantico, he's doing the God's work right now because he's still fighting, and you're still trying to convince guys in uniform that this is the way to go. Because, and like I've said before, Matt, the problem with the Marine Corps is everybody's got a damn badge. So everybody's an expert somehow. I shot marksman. I qualified. I don't see how hard it is. Yeah, but your marksman badge means shit. It means that you can hit, out of your 50 rounds given you for qualification, hit all fours, never hit the black, never hit the bullseye ever, the target, and qualify with the 200. Here's a marksman badge. Never hitting the black, ever. But I give you a badge, you get a C grade. A B grade sharpshooter, 20% black, the rest all fours, never hitting target, misses. And then we went to that, you know, 1 point for a hit in the black and a zero for a miss. When we did that initially, we had to add 15 bonus points to the 200 because that was the only way to get people to qualify. And it didn't last long because our expert badges went away. It was harder people to shoot. And our unks went up. So we got more unks. So that program only lasted shit a couple years. The hit and miss. And then we went back to the 250 points. Competition shooting. 4 for a miss. 3 for a big miss. And 2 if you hit the corner paper. 6 feet away from your intended target. And people would say, well, that's suppression. No, it's not. Suppression is when you shoot at somebody and you miss, and it hits so close to him it causes some debris or shit to hit him in the face or take his attention that he goes, holy shit, someone's shooting at me, and duck. Suppression is not when the bullet goes by your head, because when you hear the sonic crack, that bullet's already been gone.
Right. And I would argue that suppression is a deliberate thing, right? A well-aimed round, maybe, you don't know exactly where the enemy is, but you know you're shooting in front of him, and you do it deliberately to throw shit up in his face, because that will keep his head down.
The best suppression, Mac, is putting a bullet in his freaking head.
I agree with you, but one of the problems is locating his ass. Where the fuck
is
he?
Well, then you don't shoot if you don't know.
Okay.
Right now, don't
I, but Mike, but so you're, if you, but if my job, we teach it in fire and movement.
I know.
My job is to suppress. All right, and that's what we teach. So if I'm getting fired from that house and you're up and moving, I'm not going to shoot at the window where I think he is because I don't see a target while you're moving. Bullshit, man. I'm shooting. I don't care if he's there or not.
Why not lay on where you think his fire's coming from? Give sectors of fire. Give a good ADVAC. Everybody have sectors of fire, and then move. And then when that Sherman bitch pops up, go shoot your guy moving. Shoot him in the head.
Because you're moving. My job is to suppress him while you're moving, because otherwise you're going to get whacked.
The guy not moving. Look for a target. You're just shooting randomly. You're watching too many World War II movies.
No. I know. No, I know that. I know my job is to keep those automatic targets down while you're up and moving. And I know. And when I see him, I'm gonna take him. But if he's in a window and that's what I've seen, I'm gonna engage while you're moving. Now, if you're not up and moving, I'm not.
But that went away. You know why? We have optics now, Mac. You were teaching that at TBS with iron sight. I can understand that. Never saw our intended target until the Gulf War. Until we went into OAIS and we started getting optics. That was the first time we ever saw our enemy through an optic or through our weapon. Because you teach in combat or in TBS, and I mean IOC and at boot camp, to blur out your target and concentrate on front sight post. Who does that stupid shit? Who blurs their target out? You blur your target out, you don't see your target, he goes away. The optic was the first time on our rifles that we saw the enemy through our sights on our weapon.
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely no doubt.
So the rule for suppression should change. We should relook that and say, well, now I have optics. I can look. I can see where my intended target should be. Lay on that. When he pops, I shoot him. Boom.
You're right. You're absolutely right. You're 100% right.
But we have this old, we look at the problem from 1945. Cover me. I'm going to move. Suppress.
Well, who still does that? I mean, look, I mean...
Everybody does. We haven't written it out of the book yet.
That's depressing.
We used to teach, teach searching fire and machine gun.
Searching and traversing.
Well, just shoot. No, they're like, you think he's in there in the bushes? Shoot him. Just shoot in the bushes. Incinerate fire. Shoot and start a fire with, because you have incinerate bullets.
Right on. Yeah, we love that.
Redoed it. Ridiculous.
We love
it. But I got to run, man.
All right. Have a good day.
All right.
Bye. How fun was that? Huh? I love it when Mike gets fired up. He is funny. Let me tell you one thing about him. He likes to hide it, but he's a smart guy. He's a smart guy. And especially about guns. When you get him to go off like today and keep poking him, but let me tell you this, he is so frustrated with the Marine Corps and the way institutionally we do gun business. It makes him crazy. When he talks about it and he goes off like that, he'll quote you chapter and verse, how we do it in the Marine Corps and how screwed up we are. The Prince of Anger. Love this. You guys got my initials. That's right. Marshall Mathers. He's an angry guy. Living in that trailer park, man. Email Mac I love old gun radio, man. That was awesome. Optics. Crazy. Another email. Hey, can we continue this discussion? I'm really interested now. I didn't serve in the Marine Corps where there was optics. So I'm with Mac. If you're up and moving, I'm shooting at that building. I'm not waiting. But if I have optics on the weapon, that changes the whole thing. I could actually see. That's not how I know how to shoot a weapon. I mean, my hunting rifle has a scope on it, and that's way different. In combat, holy smokes, yeah, it changes things. I still don't understand the bullet thing, why the Marine Corps would go back to a bullet that goes through and through. Yeah, no, let me tell you, we will pick up this conversation. We will continue this conversation. And you know what we'll do is we'll bring some of Mike's friends on. And we'll bring some of Mike's friends and we'll do a little roundtable about it. And take your calls and comments as well. Anyway, that'll do it. Today, 72 years ago, Marines put up a flag on Mount Suribachi. And they did it twice. So when we salute them, we salute all of them. Part of the 28th Marine Regiment went up there, and there's a whole series of pictures of the first and second flag raising, and the second flag raising obviously has become an iconic symbol of the Marine Corps. One of the most reproduced images in American or any kind of photographic history. That image, yeah. So, we salute those guys today, and we'll talk about it. I mean, that battle to me is crazy interesting. The way they fought it, and just and some of the innovations. First use of whole blood, Iwo Jima. Yeah, first use of aerial medevacs, where they flew guys off the island and back to places like Guam during the battle for medical attention, Iwo Jima. And I put a couple of pictures up on Facebook here. If you have access to the All Marine Radio Facebook page, go check it out. There's Holland Man Smith, general type, lieutenant general at the time, and Harry Schmidt, general type. Okay? I don't know that either one of those guys PT'd very much. Anyway, but where the hell did this whole uniformity thing, where did we get that in the Marine Corps? Okay? So let me just walk you through their uniforms. Okay, they're not wearing the same uniform, okay? Smith, in the picture, has on dungaree bottoms, right, no leggings, dungaree top, and a piss cutter, okay? A tan piss cutter. Doesn't go with the utility uniform, all right? You have General Schmidt. He's got dungaree bottoms. He's got a khaki shirt on. He's got some kind of tanker jacket on, and he's got his utility cover on. There's two helmets sitting there. One, it's just a metal helmet. Another one, it's got the camouflage cover on it that the Marines wore. Where did this whole craziness about uniformity come from? Because it certainly wasn't an issue in World War II. But the issues are funny. Then there's another one of them sitting in the, it looks like General Smith CP. Howling Mad Smith. Both of them sitting there and in there, but kind of interesting. Again, not even close to wearing the same uniform, which is funny because we have this craziness about uniformity in the Marine Corps, and it did not exist back then. So have a great afternoon. Don't forget at some point, say a prayer for those World War II veterans that are still among us. Heroes of my youth, certainly, and on a day that the flag went up on Iwo Jima 72 years ago, on the day when flags went up on Iwo Jima 72 years ago, we salute their courage, their selflessness, and hats off to them. Anyway, have a great afternoon. We'll see you tomorrow on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. the music of anger. We like it.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.